Welcome to the One Shot Test Kitchen. Today's episode, Trophy. Hello everyone and welcome to the One Shot Test Kitchen where we try out lesser known tabletop RPGs. I'm Mike Kelly and I am joined by Samara.
Hello.
Hi, and we are talking about Trophy today, specifically Trophy Dark. Trophy Dark was a game we played yesterday, in the last episode about doomed treasure hunters in a forest. It is made by Jesse Ross and is available on TrophyRPG.com for $7. We've had a couple of days to kind of stew on it, and I guess just to start off, like, Samara, what's your impression of Trophy looking back on it?
I thought it was a great, tidy system that provided the opportunity for us to go into dark, squishy places in a way that felt collaborative on both sides of the table, both, you know, with what you were giving us and what we were as players filling in. So that like investment felt there. So I would definitely say that for a one shot spooky experience, which I think is incredibly difficult to do digitally, that it was definitely a success in that aspect.
Yeah. You sent me a text saying something like, you know, I'm out in the woods right now, and I don't know what exactly it said. But
oh, you know, it was terrible. It's been like so overcast out here in the country, and I haven't seen the stars for so long. And then we play this game where we dissolve into like galaxiness, and our beings like disappear, and all you see is like galaxy stars. And I went outside, and it was like the clearest, craziest night in so long. And the moon was super low, so it was huge, and it just looked like it was from like a sci-fi thing. And I like it was so dark, and I looked up, and I just saw like all these stars. And I was like, "Oh damn, I am spooked!" And it was dead quiet because it's so cold right now, so none of the like critters are out making noises. And I was like, "I need to go inside."
I don't know what it is about, like, for me at least, with horror that takes place in, like, nature or the woods or something. Like when I first saw Blair Witch, like, you know, like, I could not go out. And I saw that, like, at my college, which was in upstate New York, out in the countryside. And I'm like, yeah, no, I'm just not going anywhere near any trees for a week if I can possibly help it.
It's so true. It spooks me out. And, like, I'm a bit of a scaredy cat anyways, but definitely the dark and the concept of being out someplace where it's so dark that you can't see past your lantern or your flashlight, and knowing that if there is something, it's just going to be like the light reflected in an animal's eyes or something. Like, when I take the dog out to go to the bathroom at night, I'm like, please, please no eyeballs. Please no fleshy eyeballs.
Yeah, there's a certain, like, certain video games do that very well, where it's just like, you know, it just mechanically, like, you just turn a corner, like Dark Souls does this very, very well. It's like, turn a corner, giant spider, leaving. Okay, like, you know. That's, but, I mean, Trophy really wasn't a creature, like, horror. It was more like suspense and, like, to some degree, psychological horror. It's kind of interesting that, like, even though there is a strong sense of setting there, that still spooked you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, or did it, I guess, because, like, you know, or is it just kind of the residual, like, forests are scary kind of stuff? Or was the game itself scary is what I'm trying to ask here.
Yeah, I mean, I think because it was psychological and not creatures, it was scarier to me. So it allows for more, as it's rumbling in my brain afterwards, to sit there and go, like, are we all just the figments of some giant's imagination that's sleeping on a beach? Do I exist? Am I just stardust? Is that? And I think the last act, or I think they call them rings in this rule book, as it started to shift away from the very physical of like spiders and girls with clubs. And even though there was an actual like golem coming after us, the real horror was that Brendan's character when going through a thing, it no longer existed and he couldn't see it anymore when I could see it. And that difference of, which I think also, like, to get really like about it, like, I think in this day and age, the horror of our truths are wildly different and there is no way for us to make sense of those truths or to get them on the same page is like a very horrific concept to me. And in this setting, like, I even tried to brute force it. It was so funny to me. My intention at the end of that game, when I was in the library and I pulled Brendan's character, like, into the library with me, my intention was, we still got this. There's books there. Like, even though you couldn't see it, I could pull you into, like, where these things actually were. And he was telling me that, like, he thought that was my own nefariousness of being like, fuck you, man. You're going to die here. And I was like, well, I mean, I guess I did kill a girl in the forest without much flinching early on. But honestly, that was just my way of trying to get you to the place where, you know, these secrets were, which to me had to, like, get out into the world. So even in its closing moment, my final actions of trying to get us on the same page ended with us not being in the same page and then me disintegrating into, like, nothingness. Or I don't know, could I have woken up and been like, you just imagine that? Like, nightmare scenarios like that, like, really stick with me because I can get really lost in, like, what is reality? That's a scary concept that I could just spiral on for a long time. And if you're out here in the woods when it's pitch black and silent, when normally there's a lot of, like, critters making noises, all of a sudden you're like, wait, is this the moment that I realize that I live in the Matrix or something? I don't know.
No, totally. I mean, like, part of the so you alluded to this a little bit throughout, and I want to talk a little bit about the kind of the structure of the incursion itself. So the incursion is the scenario, and it's set up in a number of different ways. You alluded to the rings, and the rings, they're kind of like, these are situations that occur, but they kind of each, like, circle, each ring surrounds each other so that, or maybe, like, goes down deeper in terms of, like, establishing the theme of this and, like, establishing the characters as well as you do that. And it's designed to do that. And the girl with the club, which was the first ring, the thing it is meant to establish is, like, what are these characters' relationship to violence?
Yes, and I saw, like, that.
And what is its, you know, how easy are they to go into that?
Mm-hmm.
And then the next session is you're always trying to express what they call the theme, and the theme of this dungeon was dreams. I kind of interpreted that to be dreams, sleep, night, all that kind of stuff. Part of what, like, kind of spiraled out from that is that, like, okay, you had two people with very different perceptions of what was going to happen in that very first ring. Like, the girl's like, I am just going to go kill these people or get by them and get to the treasure.
Mm-hmm.
You guys at the very beginning are like, come with us. And she was having none of that. So it's like, you start with that, like, misperception of reality. Go into these situations where you're still misseeing reality. Like, you're seeing different things in different ways and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't ever really seen a structure like this, like, in a game, because it is so thematic. A lot of times it's like, you know, like, these are the encounters you'll have. Roll on a D100 and see what encounter you get.
Mm-hmm.
I found, like, number one, I think if I were to design something around a common theme, like, that would be, like, a really interesting world-building thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to know, I guess, from your point of view, how effective was it, now that you've read the book?
Yeah.
Like, how effective and where do you think the line lies between, like, the game itself dictating some of the structure and, like, the stuff that was kind of improv created between you and me and Brendan as we were going through it?
I feel like, having looked at the rule set now, this gets pretty damn near close to, like, the Goldilocks paradox, where it gives you enough as a game master to go with. And even at the beginning, I think that there's, like, its own version of a D100 list where it's like throughout, if you need stuff to help you, like add in any of these elements for like texture. And I think that stuff's really helpful. Like
that was very smart. Yeah, just real quick, mechanically, what it is like list like things you would see or things that would be like setting details. And that was stuff like the dragonflies and the walking through mud and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And as a player, it was really effective when it came out. And like, I remember like the hardest I ever went on a D&D campaign was in a city setting where I knew that it was all always every session was always going to be in the same city. So I just found a bunch of player created resources on like DriveThruRPG or whatever that gave me at the ready those types of tables to add texture and to see what players hook on to. And I think sometimes when you're running a game and you're trying to build a world, our own imaginations can be limiting in their own way. And so it's really nice to have something like that that's like easy, but like not overly complicated. It's just like pick one from this list and throw it in and all of a sudden see what that seed sort of textures out into and inspires in the players. And there's a lot, I think, in this game that's like, you know, I think that the finding rations that they didn't pack situation is a thing that happens. But the way that you had it happen and the way that you prompted Brennan's and, you know, character to engage and answer those questions was very unique to our situation. We're given something that feels bizarre and creepy, like, why is this in the bag? But we're fleshing it out a little bit more and making it ours in a way that me, as a player who was asleep at the time, was very disturbed by and kept bringing up. And he was so pissed. He was like, Samara, you were asleep. You didn't know I ate that bread. And for him, like, he was very invested in the player that was like, whoa, well, I guess I forgot that I put this in here. Like, he was very much giving into a sensibility of a character that was kind of almost entranced by these oddities that were popping up in the world.
Mm.
I think the amount that he was allowed to define those things and how specific they were, what your prompts were, allowed for that kind of engagement with it. I think it does do a good job of giving the person creating the mission enough to go on, but with the flexibility to make it their own, and the players a really great runway to jump in and engage. Another thing that we talked about after the game that this made us think of was in a lot of role-playing games, when you take a lore stat type thing, or you're like somebody who knows a lot about a thing, it is still tied to, well, did you read the monster's manual? Or like, or it requires you to ask the DM, like, I know a lot about the gangs in this area. So like, do I know the guy who works in the second in command there? And I liked that this game set it up where it's like, oh, well, you've got a lore skill. So tell me what are the stories that you remember from whatever, or that it allows for you to define the world. And it's not so tied to like, oh, we put out 50 million rule books. And so like the lore is actually a thing you need to know. It feels more organic that way.
No, absolutely. And I think that's kind of a consequence of the fact that like it is a one shot. It is designed to be a just one adventure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you have a campaign setting, like, you know, be it a D&D, like, you know, like, I know a lot about the Dragonlance setting because, like, I played that. I love that setting.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can tell you the names of the three moons. I can tell you, like, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I think part of the benefit of, not benefit, that's the wrong word. Part of the strength of Trophy is that this is a common situation or, like, you know, a very tropey kind of situation. I don't mean that in a negative way. But, like, you know, you're going into a dark forest.
Yeah.
Like you are going into a place that is spooky in a very particular kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
And you're doing it in a milieu, you know, a fantasy milieu that is just kind of genericized. But when you do get to that point where you have to start defining these things, you can define it. Like you can, you do have the room to actually flesh out. Like one of the lines is literally, what are the myths associated with this, like this figure on this statue?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, like, let's actually build around this. Like, there are no rules here. There are no, like, you know, like, because the backstory doesn't really, quote unquote, matter for, like, where you're going or, like, what you're doing. But it does matter for the characters and how they would perceive this. It's not that they, like, you know, It's not that like this king had these riches and whatnot. It's what you know about this king and why you're okay with pillaging his tomb.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that I'm thinking about how in any of these longer form multi-session tabletop RPGs, that there is room for that definition of the world, even if there are consequences. But sometimes longer form campaign tabletop RPGs and the way in which they're structured, it's really hard for players to get out of a sort of min-max mentality. And so if they are a lore master, the lore that they want to pull up feels very keyholed into the challenge we're facing, the story we're telling at this moment. Whereas something like this, that was a one-shot, we had no idea what the lore, because we didn't have a clear picture. We knew we were going to this tomb, but you know, we didn't know what filling in the details on that were. So it gave us a little bit more freedom, I think, to define it. And, you know, whether or not we had no concept of how much you were going to have to fill in or how much that was going to benefit us or like screw us in the end. And for me, it's like a sort of advice to players, because I think that every game, like I think the traditional tabletop campaign, like tabletop RPGs that are campaign form, have the room for this. I think so long as like GMs and DMs and players alike have an agreement that like, yeah, okay, we can do that. And I'm not going to be an asshole and be like, so I'm best friends with the guy who runs the prison that we're trying to break into because I know people. It's like, no, like, come on. Because it's so satisfying. Like this game and those moments were so satisfying to me to fill out. And you know, to your point, like they're throwaway nothing things, but also not, because they give you some grounding and investment and texture that I think is really important, that allows things like horror or emotional beats to actually happen.
Oh, totally. I agree with all that. But I think the danger that you run into sometimes is like, yeah, like when you are in a particular setting, be it Blades in the Dark, Dragonlance, something like that, there's guardrails around you. Like, you know, there's certain things there. Trophy had very little of that. Trophy had like, you know, again, you're in a forest. What is this? Like, you know, there's a certain paradox of possibility that happens when you do that. And it's probably smart that it doesn't, like, it starts out with a combat encounter. Like, it starts out with a, like, an actual interpersonal conflict. And then the lore comes a little bit later, once you've had a little bit of time to settle in. If I were to just ask you, like, okay, so what are the myths of this world? That's hard. About what? Like if I were to ask you, what are the myths of Earth? Like where the hell would I start? What culture? What, you know?
Right.
But, like, the thing that it does that I think is smart is that it anchors it to specific things. It anchors it to, okay, who is this king? Even the bread was like, okay, the bread is tied to a memory. What's the memory? You know, and what does that memory mean? When I told you, like, you know, you dream of something, I could ask, what's your dream? But I could say, oh, you dream of the monastery. What was the monastery like? You know, like, you know, what do you dream about in that monastery? And like, it does allow you to give you a point of contact to actually spread out from that.
Yes.
Which is incredibly, like, that's how you have to do it, I think, in a lot of these cases, because, yeah, otherwise you just kind of wide open. I don't know, man. Like, you know, neither one of us can really come up with something.
Absolutely. Well, again, it's why I keep talking about the Goldilocks paradox. But I just think that there is value, and that great creativity can happen with the right restrictions. I think that the wrong restrictions feel heavy and clunky and weigh you down. And the most exciting restrictions, and in this case, by restrictions, I mean story prompts, but also game mechanics, can free you up to a lot more that you wouldn't have gone to before, because the mechanics make you feel safe. The tether that you have, or the guideline that you have, like, gives you some confidence that whatever you think of from that prompt is acceptable. Sometimes, you know, I talk to people who play open world, who can't play open world RPGs, because they're like, yeah, I mean, I know there's like 50 symbols on my compass that I could go run around and do, but like, where the fuck do you even start? And they want like more of those guardrails, whereas some people are like, I do not want to play an interactive movie. So, you know, video games themselves have their own sort of, you know, autonomy thing. And people like different things. But I think that if for role-playing games, more and more, it's just like that recognition that it's a vulnerable experience for people on both sides of that table. There are some people who, I don't know, indulge in it too much. And I say this as like an actor type person, but like there are actors and actor type people who can really sort of hog space or be like almost starved for the opportunity to play characters and imagine things. And I think that if you have I think that the system did a really good job, because I think that it figured out the right spot to be like, here's your leash, but it doesn't feel restricting. It feels like just enough for you to like go out and be comfortable and kind of enjoy and engage with this and know that everybody's on the same page, which I think for a one shot is like so important, that your restrictions and your rule system have to ensure that everybody's on the same page. Because, you know, a long form campaign, first session was awkward. Second session, now we found our groove. But a one shot, you kind of all got to be there from the start for it to be successful.
Yeah. And you have to have buy-in like almost immediately. I mean, I think there's certain things in the character creation as well that allow for that buy-in. Like, you know, the selection of a drive, like the selection of, you know, okay, so you're searching for treasure. Why? Like, what is the actual motivation here for you, aside from like just, you know, money?
Right.
Like, yeah, I mean, absolutely in terms of that. And then like, extrapolating from that and other points of character creation and world creation that like kind of creates that tapestry.
Mm-hmm.
I think this game, I mean, I think there are certain things that it's not, I don't know the right word here, it's not efficient in its world building, because like it allows for world building that is not relevant, or not, I don't want to say not relevant, because like that implies it was like extraneous. Like, I liked all the world building we did, but it didn't come into play in a lot of cases. And I think that's fine in a certain sense, but like, I think that
I'm going to challenge that. What's one piece of like world building that you felt was extraneous in that it wasn't like, it served no other purpose than just defining it?
So specifically, I'm thinking about the historiosity of the king that we were talking about. I asked the question, like, you know, how did that kingdom fall? And, got an answer. But that never really came into play. Like, it was taken over by the church. Okay, but what does that imply? And that, like, you know, that there was no follow-up to that. Like, okay, so what does that mean? Does that mean this king is now reviled? Does this mean this king is now deified?
Interesting, because for me, the definition of that grounded me and led me to be as desperate as I was in that last ring to get Brendan's character to get the information and share it out, because it really grounded me in the idea that like we once knew a renaissance as a people and it's been locked away and like kept from people. We need to go back to a time where like knowledge is accessible by everybody. So having that conversation, fleshing that out, I agree with you. There are certain aspects that we never really dug into deeper. But by doing that, I feel like I had a clearer sense of my character drive and like where it came from and what it was tied to and why this tomb specifically was one that I needed to go to and risk my life to go raid. So it was it's interesting because it served that purpose for me, even though and it made me feel more oddly, like it raised the stakes, because if there was this, the way in which we talked about this culture having, you know, almost like an Atlantis type culture that like was at a level that we don't know today and is locked away, it made it feel that much more important to go see it and that much scarier. Like, of course it's going to be hidden in a deep dark wood because of all these other reasons. So
sure.
It's interesting that, of course, for your perspective as the game master, like it wouldn't have clicked through because you're thinking about, okay, how do I call back to this? And like, you did such a great job of that. But for me as a player, like it did serve that purpose for me in terms of like enriching my role-playing experience, which I will admit is really hard for me. Like I will do a lot of role-playing, but like most times I'm like, okay, I really believe in this one. Like,
so I do want to clarify that, like, it's not that I was trying to tie it into the story, because not everything needs to tie into the story, everything we create. But specifically for that, like, I was trying to determine from that story and from that understanding of how people knew about the king, like, what was his nature and what is his nature now? Mm. Like, is it a malevolent presence? Like, is it, like, a restless presence? Is it a protective presence? Like, and you guys didn't necessarily need to have those answers, but I felt I did. Because that would help, like show how this would be played. And I don't think I ever got that answer. Mm. Like, I never knew, like, he had to be threatening because it was a horror story. Like, but there's different flavors to horror or to something that is pursuing you.
He could have been creepily benevolent. That's also, like, horrific in its own way.
No, absolutely. Yeah, he could have been like, oh, yes, like, you know, I'm devoted to the preservation of knowledge, so I'm going to preserve you here forever.
Yeah, right.
But that's the thing. Like, I never had a clear picture of what he was, so it kind of led to a one-dimensional kind of portrayal of that creature, of that presence, which... Mm. Like, it's not a bad thing per se, because I think it was still effective.
Sure.
But, like...
Missed opportunity, maybe.
Missed opportunity for texture, certainly. Mm. And for a deeper role-playing thing versus just, like, a pursuit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, like, ultimately, the idea of trophy is that you guys undo yourselves, which is what happened.
Is there no winning? Can you remind me... Is there no quote unquote like winning? Is there no leaving with the knowledge? Like, no matter what, are you doomed?
I believe so. Let me double check. I'm actually going to look at the rule book here very quickly, because I remember the last ring is like, just keep giving them awful choices. And I'm assuming that means, and then it'll correct it. Like, any problems will correct itself, 'cause they'll just be dead.
I like this. Make everything tragic is the last line of the scenario.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it doesn't explicitly say that you have to fail.
Right.
And, like, in some sense, you didn't. Like, some of that knowledge got out in the end. But, like, the price you paid was tragic and extremely high.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, this thing...
Well, so I like that for an ending, right? That they don't say... There is no way that they succeed this, right? Like, I think that there's an elegance to your clues that you were given from the rule book of these things pop up, kind of describe them in this way. There's the things that are going to happen. Just make sure it's tragic, or, like, make sure they always have to do rolls, you know, against doing it and sort of see where it goes. So for me, reading that, putting on my Game Master hat, I would really like those kinds of... guidelines from a rule book. What did you find as the game master? Did you feel like this game gave you too much or too little in terms of instruction? And did you like running it given what they gave you?
That's a tough question to answer. I liked the structure in which it's like, you know, like, this is ring three. Ring three is psychological,
mm-hmm.
or whatever it was. Ring four is monstrous. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, those are the kinds of things that you want to, like, okay. This is the mood here. This is the particular manifestation of this horror,
mm-hmm.
which gives you, like, okay, as a GM, like, that's what you want to know. Like, you want to know not necessarily the ins and outs of what the particulars of this monster is, but, like, what are you trying to evoke in the players and in the scenes here?
Mm-hmm.
Part of the, like, the core thematic thing of Trophy, as far as I can tell, is the disintegration of the party.
Mm-hmm.
You turn on each other, like, you start backbiting each other, all that kind of stuff. That was hard, mainly because, well, for a couple of reasons, like there were two of you, and it was hard. Like, just because, like, okay, I have to put you, like, very clearly at conflict with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And even in the end, that I don't think that really worked for your character, because you were still like, please help me. Like,
right.
But I think where this game could use a little bit more... like, more in the way of rails is, like, okay, how do you start sabotaging that dynamic? And they do have some of it.
Mm.
Like, you know, like, something they want falls into the hands of someone else.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, I can't force that. Like, I can't really, right. like, it. What if there is, like, a situation that shows up where, like, the thing you get is literally in your hands? Then I have to take it away from you, which feels cheap.
Yeah.
I think in terms of, like, crafting scene, mm-hmm. it is absolutely, it is very, very good. It gives you a lot of tools to work with.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in terms of crafting the social dynamics, it's very much reliant on the players and on like GM skill in trying to set those situations up where that can be exploited. Like, it doesn't give the GM a lot of tools to do that.
And well, and so it makes me think more broadly. I hear you on that, and I think that I agree with you on that from what I've seen of the rule book and what I experienced as a player. My preference is ultimately not to necessarily have, I was going to say my preference is to not have that stuff in a rule book. But on the flip side, I think about, like, there are some people I play with that, oh, and especially if you're playing with the same group time and time again, you're inevitably going to fall into certain roles. So having a game that challenges those character dynamics and gives you rules and structures with which to, like, fuck with those dynamics is really useful for, I think, groups of players that, that play together all the time and maybe kind of fall into the same shtick. So I can see the value for it, because I was about to kick off and be like, I have no value for that. And it's like, actually, no, I do. I can think of like at least three different groups of people that I'm like, it would be really great if I could force you guys to engage with each other differently. I think in the context, I agree with you that having two people, it was harder. I'm not sure that my takeaway was that I think an element of the game's goal is that adversarial nature to the treasure hunters, but I think that only exists so that, like, the stakes and the horror of it, like, feel more intense, that you're like, oh gosh, I'm alone in this, or I can't even trust. It's like, it's a way to stoke paranoia, which is also very typical of, like, mythos horror. So that would be, in this instance, I feel like the only value of doing that. And I feel like that paranoia and that craziness was kind of already there for us as players afterwards, kind of talking about. So it didn't have to be as explicit as Hesse took the thing that he wanted. I mean, he saw that and he was already pissed at me.
Sure, yeah.
And in his delusion, like, he was pissed at me so that when I called him back in, he couldn't even see that I was trying to give him a gift. He was like, this bitch. Like, so to an extent, it was created, but it wasn't as maybe combative or explicit as maybe it could have been. But to your point, I hear you that it's like, well, we had to do that on our own, that you didn't have any tools in your toolkit to help get us to that point.
No, totally. And it's funny to me you bring up that moment where, like, or Bertrand got the vision and then came back, because of everything we did, that was the one moment in the game that felt very unearned at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was a very clear, like, I mean, obviously think perceptions are being skewed and everything like that. But, like, that felt like, oh, this is a, like, he just saw a vision. This did not actually happen. Like, because he was literally transported to a different space and then transported back. But, like, when Bertrand came back, he had just flipped. Like, he had just basically, like, okay, she is dangerous now. Like, because I've seen this. And I'm like, that seems a little too much like the game requires him to do that. As opposed, and I think Brendan played along. And I think, like, I mean, I'd love to ask him, like, you know, what he thought about that moment, actually. Because, like, for me, it felt like the game demands this. So now you must do this.
Yeah. Well, he's very much so a player in my experience as his wife, who's played a lot of games with him. He's a great player because he's a great player to test the rules of a game, because he will have zero pushback and go, what's the rule? Everybody's purple? Mm-hmm. Everybody's purple. What's the and they eat bananas? Great. And they shove them under their armpits? Okay. Everybody's purple and they eat bananas and then shove them under their armpits. Like,
I would love to know what game this is.
So he's purple people eaters. Yeah, so he inherently, when he plays games, is very yes, okay, and goes along with it and doesn't feel like the game has forced him to that decision. I think it's like he's and I do think this comes a little bit like from our own performance and theater backgrounds and whatever, that you're like, well, if I tell you X, this only works if you agree that X is X. There's so many players that we play with that are very cerebral and that need that logic and like, well, why did my character do whatever? And for him, he's like, well, then this just means that the logic of my character, it goes back to the bread thing. I was sitting here asleep and being like, it's creepy that the bread's in there. And he's like, or what if it's not? Like, what if I'm just a guy who's like, because how else do you play the idea of being overtaken by this madness and this idea of like giving a bit into these delusions that you're seeing if you don't believe them some, if not all of the time, and go, oh, okay, well, then that's real. So this bread, like, you know, the bread could have been maggots or disgusting things. Mm. But to him, he was like, well, it's this delicious thing. And I don't want to consider the alternative. I want to consider that it is this. And I think he was really role playing the idea that like the delusions, much like he allowed himself to get bit by a spider to kind of see where it goes. I think he was like, well, let's go on this psychedelic trip and see what just believing the things I see where it takes me. It could also come with his history of like experimenting with psychedelics, and he's a lot more open to being go on the ride. But
oh, this is an LSD trip. I know this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So I feel like, yeah, for him personally, I think that that's a, I can see the other side of that to what you're trying to lay out and saying about the game kind of forcing it. But also, at a certain point, a game has to give you a wall to respond to. And I would argue is sometimes more fun if you're like, okay, let's go along with it rather than fighting it and being like, why would I all of a sudden believe that? And it wasn't so far from, you know, reality, because it's not like we had established for our characters that we were like deep friends for years or anything else like that.
Sure.
And I had kicked it off by killing a girl in the forest that you just sort of went along with, which arguably did actually happen, but could arguably just be as like a horrific a hallucination as anything else.
No, that's fair. I mean, I think this might come down to this is kind of enlightening, really. Like, the way that I think both of us approach these types of games, like the idea that, like, you know, the game demands it, so let's roll with it. Like, you know, I can understand that point of view, but like, it doesn't feel right to me to move in that direction without some kind of background and some kind of backing. You know, this game didn't provide that. Like, you know, my DMing, like, you know, like didn't build it up effectively. I don't want to blame the game for this.
Sure.
Yeah, that's why, like, you know, when I want things to follow in a very kind of interesting manner, but in a way that makes sense to not just the players, but to those that are, like, on the outside of it. Like, if you saw this as a movie, it's a horror movie trope as old as time, like, you know, don't go in that goddamn room.
Yeah.
Like, or why are you doing something you clearly wouldn't do? And I wanted to avoid that, and I don't felt that I did. And because I don't felt I gave an adequate enough justification for why he would flip. I think this might just be a philosophical difference, though.
Yeah.
I like, you know, I mean, this isn't a movie. This is a game, certainly. I don't know what the right answer is. I don't think there is a right answer. I don't know. I think it just elucidates the different ways that we approach games to some degree.
Certainly. Well, and also just interpreting a story, right? That like you, that from where you were sitting in the building blocks of the story, it felt like an unearned character evolution.
Mm.
I think from his perspective, it was like, well, she went in there and was a selfish SOB and like did all of that. So no, like screw her. Like he was very fired up by the idea that like, again, I think he was invested in the narrative that we were only friends because we were working towards a sort of same goal of pushing ourselves and we had similar morals to an extent, but that it was always kind of a tenuous relationship. And so to see me betray him in that way confirmed a sensibility of like, well, you can't trust anybody. And I think he established himself as kind of a loner that had been kicked out of things. So I think for him, getting to a place of mistrust with somebody added to this idea that like hallucinations are real. I think the thing that actually undercut it was having me show back up and then run into nothingness. And I think that for him, that was like disorienting of like, oh, well, I just believed that she did that and I hate her. But now I see her again. And now she's off going someplace that I can't go. And then when I pulled him to where I was, he was furious about it, I think, because of the vision he had had before. So I think, you know, it is all about like where you're sitting, because there have been plenty of times that I have been in a GM or a DM position and I have felt that exact same thing of you. I was like, this story point does not feel logical or earned. And then like you go for your break and your drink refill or the game is over and you're talking with the players and the players are just effusive about that moment, that experience. And it's a good reminder too for me of like, oh yeah, it always feels so different when you're on like the proverbial like narrator side of these collaborative stories, because you see all eventualities or possibilities, whereas as a player I only see the choice that was sort of in front of me or the few steps ahead of me, and so I have to make that choice from there. And so it's often that disconnect, I think, is happens in these games where the players felt something and felt it was more earned than necessarily the DM or the GM feels, because they're like, I mean, like for me, sometimes I'm like, I just kind of threw you in there.
Oh, yeah, you know, totally. Like the GM kind of point of view is like, sometimes it works out, even though like it doesn't go according to plan. And that's, you know, and that's not only fine, that's sometimes like the whole point of it. Absolutely.
Do you like this dice system?
Hold on. Why don't we take a quick break and we will come back and we will talk mechanics. And we're back. So what'd you think of this dice system?
I like it. It's a lot like Blades in the Dark, right?
Oh, it specifically name checks Blades in the Dark in the book. Yeah. Like, absolutely.
Yeah, which is a dice system I really like. I feel like it did a good job of, in these horror stories, you want it to feel really difficult. So it felt difficult. I liked the mechanic where you and a player determined how it could turn out, and that you or a player could offer a devil's bargain.
Oh, 100%. Like the added buy-in from the group like makes it much more collaborative. 100%. And I think it would also add to like the feeling of like, oh yeah, I'm fucking over this person, and it would kind of blur the line between the players and the characters that they are playing as they kind of, that whole bond disintegrates.
Yep.
I will say there are some important differences between this and Blades, just because in Blades in the Dark, like generally speaking, you succeed just with complications on dice rolls. Here you can straight up fail. And like here you can, like in Blades, it's very, very rare that you don't do what you're trying to do. Here it's just straight up like, yeah, that doesn't work. Like it literally says in the book, like, you know, I think on a 1-3, you fail. I think that's a very deliberate choice. I think that is like, you have to have failure here. You know, you're not a group of heroes. You're going up against something that is actively working against you and wants you to fail and die to some degree.
It feels like Night Witch is that way. It feels like Night Witch is that way. Yeah. I mean, I think this goes back to like how do mechanics play into your world building and give you sufficient things. Like having a dice mechanic, I feel like the game that we played that Son of Banana Chan did,
Jiangsha.
Yeah, that one also had a mechanic that like dovetailed so beautifully into the world that they were building and the ways that they were doing it. And this dice mechanic, both how difficult it is and how collaborative it is, I felt like was just like really effective to both driving the wedge between players, getting buy-in on that world building, and also like reminding you of like how difficult things were. Which I think helps remove that false sense of like hero complex that like a lot of games, like you play some games to be a hero, you play some games, you know, not to be or to do impossible things. And I felt like this mechanic system helped get me in the right set as a player and honestly like pushed me to murder to a certain extent where I was like,
oh, yeah.
I was like, well, continually rolling against this person is like not getting me anywhere. She's pinned on the ground. Like she can no longer be a problem if I just slit her throat. And is that so out of the question for me and my character? Nope. Okay, great. Then like, let's make that choice.
I will say there is one, I think probably my biggest criticism of the game is in the dice rolls because they're too important. And what I mean by that is that a lot of stuff happens on every die roll. On a single die roll, you could conceivably have the main situation you're trying to resolve, a consequence from that, a devil's bargain, a ruin effect, and then like whatever the new situation would be once you are done with resolving all of that. And that is a lot on every single, like, as like, for example, the thing that comes to mind is that when Bertrand was like going through the tunnel to get away while you face down the statue, it's like, okay, here's the devil's bargain. Like, okay, you lose your bag. Okay. Here's the ruin effect. You take physical harm because of this. Here's the effect of this. Like, oh, you get through, but with this complication, like you can't see what's going on behind you and you're in a new room. Hold on. I have to wait to describe the new room because I got to resolve this. There's too much going on. Like on every die roll, like I think that it was probably like one too many factors. I like the devil's bargain mechanic, I really do, but it felt like too much. Like I felt if you maybe replace that with another Blades in the Dark mechanic, like the other person is helping you get a white die, or you have a tool that like allows you to do this, get a white die, as opposed to the devil's bargain. Like, maybe move that to the effect. Like, if you fail, get a devil's bargain to reroll or something like that. It just felt like there was a lot going on in every on every die roll, and why I ended up kind of moving away from them a little bit because it was too much to keep track of.
I hear that. I think I have as somebody who has a propensity to overcomplicate all things, I think maybe at a higher I appreciated. These types of games can get so stuck in the nothingness and not progress. So I found as overcomplicated or as much as was pinned to a dice roll, I appreciated it because it was always like you'd be sitting in a moment of like horror or contemplation or paranoia or nightmares or whatever. And then a dice roll would happen, and all of a sudden it was like this whoosh, like momentum that we were in a different place. And I found that both as a player disorienting in a good way, and also gave me faith that the story's always going – that any action I take is moving things forward in a significant way. Whereas like a lot of games – the classic example is just like the mind-numbing boringness of rolling dice to do combat in Dungeons & Dragons. Or like, you know, it's like, okay, well, let's do this. You know, it's sort of like death by a thousand cuts and like whoever did their homework to read the sweetest move. Whereas this, it was like, well, the dice have real purpose. Now I'm really nervous to roll a dice because so much is hanging on it. Whether or not I have to gnaw off my arm or this goes through or it doesn't and all this kind of stuff. So it was a lot to keep track of. It was kind of clunky, but given how streamlined everything else was and how few other things drove the narrative, I didn't mind how much relied on them. And it made rolling of them, you know, much more tricky. And it made wanting to take a devil's bargain. We were taking devil's bargains all the time because we didn't have any white dice to bring to these situations.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, though. Like, I mean, your characters are much less, they have much less agency on those roles than they do while role-playing. Because, like I remember the first time we got Bertrand, I think it was when he was trying to hide to find the girl. He's like, okay, does this match my background? Not really. So I have no white dice. So how do I even attempt this? And like the two dice take lower is literally not in the book. I just took that from Blades in the Dark because like that seems like an elegant solution to that issue. But like you still need a die. Like you still feel like you need a die. Do you risk harm? Well, that's a black die and there's like pretty serious consequences from that. So you end up defaulting to the devil's bargain. And like, okay, I need a die here. Like, I need at least a legitimate shot at doing this. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. It felt I understand that the game wanted to disempower folks in the face of risky situations.
Yeah.
Because this game is a tragedy. Like, you know, this game is a long descent into shit. Like, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
But it felt like, you know, oh, you can't hide because you're not used to hiding. You know what I mean? And it's like, well, that's not fun. Like, that's not really, like, you know, you want to at least give them the chance to do this.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's a whole separate podcast we could have about, like, whether or not characters should be, you know, when you're role-playing, whether or not you should be allowed to. I fundamentally agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
And also, as I agree with you, I think But is there something like what is to be gained by preventing somebody from trying something that they don't? And I mean, I think more than anything, it just was a reminder of one, we had a smaller party, right? So we had limited skills. If we had a sure. bigger group, we probably would have had a, you know, a more physical person with us. And two, with just the two of us, I think that very early on we realized we are maybe not equipped to go find this tomb and we are really overstretching,
yeah.
which added this texture of like, okay, whatever it takes, just muscle through. Let's just get there. Let's just get there. Yeah. I mean, pros and cons to both, but I'd say on the whole, I felt very positive about the game. It was for a one shot. It was, I thought it had a lot of depth and like texture to it, but also ease of like entry.
Oh, absolutely. I'm again, my criticisms are not like, I think this is a fantastic one shot. Like, yeah. I think this was like, there's a lot that can, that this game does that I haven't really seen other games do. Like kind of the thematic plotting of it is like kind of its unique point here.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, some of the mechanics are just straight up like, you know, the dice rolling is Blades in the Dark dice rolling. There, it also name checks Cthulhu Dark, which, you know, I have not played. But this seemed to be like that they were like the dice rolling and whatnot was kind of in service of this like ring based. Theme based incursion building, like because that like it wants to evoke different moods, and they do have now a number of different incursions, all based around different like themes and whatnot. Like there's one based on the one we had was based on dreams. There's one based on fear. There's another I think based on heat, which is kind of interesting.
Okay,
totally. Like this sounds cool. Like. It's not as simple as like, you know, we're going to the ice dungeon, we're going to the fire dungeon. but it is like about like, okay, think about what all this entails and what their interpretations of these concepts are.
Mm.
It is kind of high concept in that way. Mm. Like it is like, you know, have you ever really thought about this? Have you ever really thought about like all the implications of an entire, it's almost like a short film based on a particular theme. And it just kind of plays like one of those like weird French films that are about loneliness or something right, like that.
Yeah.
Sorry, I don't mean to insult Trophy Dark. It's not one of those weird French films.
I really thought you were going to say I don't mean to insult French cinema, but
they're of a kind. Let's say.
I think there's something really beautiful about a contemplative short film. This again.
Oh, no.
Well, let's start a different podcast where we are cinema critics. I feel like it'd go terribly.
Oh, no, it would be incredibly horrific. If this conversation is anything to start, like, I'm just running off all of French cinema right now. But what I was like, but I'm saying, like, you know, the thematic expression of this, like, I think this game was, like, this game was created by sitting down and it's like, okay, we want to create a framework that allows the creation of these adventures or these modules around specific ideas. But not like mechanical ideas. Like, you know, they wanted to create it around, you know, like, you know, somewhat existential ideas or emotions or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of like, you know, oh, like it's the idea of like, you know, it takes place in the sky. Like, no, like that's interesting for like a Zelda dungeon, but not necessarily for something that is meant to be more interpersonal and more social and have that level of depth. And I think it excels at that. I think it absolutely does. I forgot what point I was making.
Well, it started with dice and then it went to French cinema and then it went to its thematic expression. I think it was an overall like thesis on the game. Because I feel like we've kind of talked. Is there anything about this game? We asked about your experience as a GM. So overall, did you enjoy like picking up, learning this rule set and running it? It was very fun for me as a player, and I can speak for Brennan as well. Like, we enjoyed it. Was it a good GM-DM experience for you?
So I think, yes. I think for a first try, it absolutely. I think, honestly, I missed part of the GMing intention here. And I think the creation of the incursions is probably, like, half the game for the GM. Because I think, you know, it's one thing to have presets and like they have, or, you know, this absolutely was a good preset. But like, what if I wanted to like explore a dungeon based on the concept of like being alone in the dark? Mm. Like, you know, like that particular like primal fear, and I want to kind of tease that out into everything. And I think a lot of the brainstorming and the creation and putting pen to paper to create that, and like there's literally a section where it's like, you know, these little moments that like that occur, like what are these little like seeds of scenes that like, you know, you can put in. I think that is probably half the fun.
Sure.
From the jamming point of view.
Would you for 2022, would you make an incursion for us to run?
I mean,
like, or are you not so into the system that you're like, I don't think I want to go back and have that experience?
I mean, we'll see. We're fresh off Trophy Dark, so I'm not 100% sure I want to, like, I'm not really thinking about playing it again at the moment. I am curious to see how, like, Trophy Gold, the other versions of it handle this. Mm. Because this is kind of a simple way to go about it. And, like, I know Trophy Gold implements, like, tokens and cards and shit like that. So I'm curious how it expresses that. But, like, I would almost create an incursion regardless of whether or not it was meant to be played.
Okay.
Yeah. Because I think the idea, I think the fun, or at least a good part of the fun would be, all right, what does this look like in mm-hmm, my head? Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Well, I'm excited to read whatever your incursion journal is about, because I feel like you have maniacal machinations. Your brain would go to an interesting place, I feel like, whether or not we played it.
Oh, that's what I'm worried about. Yes. I mean, yeah, I think this is also a very dark system. Like, this is, I think, probably the most on-screen murder we've had in any of our games.
It's true. We don't really do a lot of that. Maybe we should do it more. Maybe we should do it less. I don't know. You tell us. Do you want more?
Do you want more bloody gore?
Yeah, do you want more on-pod murder?
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think, but like, I don't think it was gratuitous. I think it was effective for what it was and all that kind of stuff. Any final thoughts on this? I guess, you sound like you'd definitely play this again. I mean, maybe in a bigger group, more time.
I'd play it in a bigger group. I'd play a different incursion. I am curious about creating, because you know me, I play every game and yeah. I'm like, let me just Samara this up. So yeah, I'd be curious about like digging into what creating your own incursion is like. Yeah. I mean, I have such a hard time envisioning the circumstances with which any of these games in my real life I would play. Like, I'm so thankful that we have like this focus to get to experience a lot of these, because I'm like, who would I break this out with in what setting? This is one of the ones that I would most likely bring out, because I think particularly for folks who are not well-versed in role-playing, that it did hit a good mechanics, and, you know, the mechanics aren't overly complicated, and that the tethers are just strong enough that I think it could give somebody some confidence and some appropriate guardrails with which to kind of dive into a role-playing experience. And as much as I think at least this specific incursion really like pit people against them, even if that was the one that I was running, there is something collective about the experience, even if you ended up totally screwing each other by the end. So I'd say, yeah, it might be a good game to break out for first timers to a tabletop RPG experience. It feels very accessible for that.
I'd be really curious. I feel that this is a GM's game. Like, I feel that that could be good for first-time players, because, like, you know, they just kind of, in my experience, first-time players just kind of lean back a little bit and let things go.
Yeah.
But, you know, and, like, this gives the GM a lot more, control over setting, not necessarily over action, that I think, I don't know. I don't know, honestly, how, I mean, it's obviously going to depend on personality and everything like that. I think for a first-time player, I wonder. I really wonder what they're... not from thematic stuff, but, like, you know, put this up against, like, what, like, a normie thinks of D&D. And,
yeah.
It's very different.
Yeah, it is. It's true. And I could imagine just, like, the deer in a headlights from those early moments. Because there's so much, if you haven't played these games, there's so much of a sense of, like, what's allowed and what's right and wrong. And so it's like hard to know where to go or what you can do. So, yeah, I hear you on that. Okay, so maybe I walk back the first timer thing. But I would, I guess, to more elegantly answer your question, I liked this game. I would be interested what it would be like to make my own incursion. If I heard that someone was running this or we needed to pull out a game, I'd be like, yeah, let's give this a run. I would play again.
Yeah. I think that's a good way to think about it.
It doesn't make sense. Don't worry. You walked it back. I feel like my answer to your question made about as much sense as like your French cinema thesis. Like, definitely. We were a little bit sprawly in our answers. But yes, I would play again.
At any rate. So that's going to do it for Trophy, I think. All right, I think that's going to be it for Trophy. And if you are interested in giving it a run, you can find it on Trophy RPG for $7, along with the other versions. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to the pod on your podcast service of choice, and leave a review if you're so inclined, or a rating, or what have you. If you have any comments or questions for us, or suggestions for things that we should take on in the future, please drop us a line at osdkpodcast@gmail.com and follow us on Twitter at @OSTKpodcast. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next time.
Bye.
God, we're just a mess at this point.
I mean, I really thought that I was going to make this edit easy for you, and I feel like I really just, like, fucked up the landing.
No. Like, I'm cutting all this out. They're like, this is very clearly going to be the end thing.
Okay, go ahead.